Hello, it's Tuesday, the 19th of October. I'm Richard Spur for Andrew Pearce, coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Still to come, could plans to ban the installation of conventional gas boilers by 2035 provoke a worrying public backlash for the government? Why Health Secretary Sajid Javid could have a full-scale rebellion on his hands as GPs are told to ignore his new face-to-face appointment guidelines? You'll get the latest business news from the city and how a song about mental health is proving a hit with kids. But first, do you fear that before the year is out, will be in lockdown again? Well, despite promises from Boris Johnson's government, half of British adults think there will be further COVID lockdowns in 2021, according to a new poll by Savanta Comres. Three in five believe that a short firebreak lockdown would be effective at relieving pressure on the NHS. Well, I'm joined now by Chris Hopkins, who's the Associate Director at Savanta Comres, who conducted that survey. Chris, why do so many Brits think that there'll be further lockdowns?
I mean, I think ultimately, Rich, the public are a little bit, you know, once bitten, twice shy. I think ultimately the government have gone back on assurances and promises ever since the start of the pandemic about restrictions. We've heard many times that from the Prime Minister himself that there wouldn't be any further restrictions, and then the government have had to go back on that. So I think that the public are probably fairly cautious and have been here before, ultimately, in the sense that the government have promised things that they weren't able to deliver. I think at the same time, the public are aware that that the winter does bring additional pressures and stresses to the NHS, in any normal year, let alone in the midst of a pandemic, which we are still. And in addition to that, because there wasn't much of a flu season last year, I think it's likely to be considerably worse this year for the NHS. So I think all of those things sort of put together, I think it's fairly understandable that the public are fairly cautious and possibly not necessarily expecting, but fearful that there may end up being further restrictions later this year.
I'm slightly surprised at your findings because, you know, looking as we all do at the daily figures of infections and deaths, they're pretty stable. You know, it doesn't look like we're heading for an upsurge. So I just wonder why people are quite so sceptical of the government's actions.
I mean, I think that, you know, some of the latest figures are considerably worse in the UK than they are across the rest of Europe. Having said that, obviously, I think one thing that the public have been very positive about throughout the pandemic, particularly obviously in 2021, has been the success of the vaccine rollout. So, yeah, I think it would be, the figures are a little bit surprising, but I do think that that it's likely to be down to the public just, you know, fearing that things could get a lot worse. Ultimately the government have been, whether you think this is a good thing or not, they have been fairly lockdown and restriction happy throughout the pandemic. So perhaps there's an impression from the public that they would just not be surprised to see the government go down that route once more.
Well, I mean, I think that they've had to be, and I think broadly the government have followed the science. And of course, economically, it is so devastating for the country to have a lockdown, and indeed to have another one, I think, would be the final sort of nail in the economic coffin. But let me ask you about the ages of the people that you surveyed. Was there a difference in response when it came to age range?
Yeah, a little bit. I think, older people generally have been a bit more fearful about the pandemic in general, about, you know, catching coronavirus, etc. But I think they are also more, they've always been a bit more open to lockdowns. I think we have seen, particularly in more recent months, younger people be less convinced that lockdowns are necessary really to control the spread of the virus, particularly with the vaccine rollout. So yeah, you know, older people do tend to be a little bit more cautious about these things, and are probably slightly more expecting, or sort of slightly more likely to expect, that there may be further restrictions this winter.
You know, when you look at the relative success of the vaccine rollout in the UK compared to other countries like America, Russia, and others, surely those people that you've been speaking to have acknowledged the fact that actually the government has done a pretty good job, and the scientists and the NHS a pretty good job when it comes to vaccinations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, there were really kind of two big turning points throughout the course of the pandemic in terms of public opinion. The first one was when Dominic Cummings went up to Barnard Castle, and all sort of government government support dropped off pretty quickly when that happened, but they have managed to claw it back somewhat due to the vaccine rollout this year. And it was probably at its peak, you know, in sort of March, April, when it was starting to have, you know, a real impact on our everyday lives. I think there is an impression from the public that if we did go back into further restrictions, whether that was, you know, full lockdown or something a little bit softer, I think there would possibly be a skepticism then about what the point in the vaccine was. And I think if we're going to have booster jabs and things like that, I think that there may be a bit of a skepticism from the public that the vaccine rollout has been as successful as perhaps they initially thought. And that may damage the government slightly. But I think on the whole, the vaccine rollout has been considered by the public a massive success. And I think that's going to be, you know, one thing that the government are going to have to really cling to when the pandemic is over and the inquiry comes around.
I've been abroad recently in France and Italy and Spain, and many people there, I've noticed, are still wearing masks, not just always in shops and banks and post offices, but even in the streets. Now, that isn't the case if you walk around a town or city in the UK. I just wonder whether people would be prepared to comply to the new regulations if we were to have some sort of form of lockdown again.
Yeah, I do think it would be quite difficult for many members of the public to go back. And I think one thing that pollsters in general have struggled with throughout the pandemic is the difference between public opinion and public behaviour. And I think that it's all well and good, you know, people saying that they would be supportive of lockdowns and supportive of further restrictions and possibly even expecting them to come into place. But whether they actually adhere to them and abide by them is a different story. And yeah, you know, as you say, there's lots of anecdotal evidence at the moment that mask adherence and you know, the general kind of sort of how people are still coping and living with the pandemic is very different in the UK to other countries. And I think that is, you know, largely down to the success of the vaccine rollout. But at the same time, you know, I think if the government were to go backwards again this winter, even if it was something as you know, fairly straightforward as wearing face coverings again, I think that they would be unlikely to see the same level of compliance as they did perhaps when it was first brought in, or even, you know, a few months ago this year.
And indeed, that may affect the government's decision. Interesting. Chris, many thanks. That was Chris Hopkins, Associate Director at Savanta Comres. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Plans to ban the installation of conventional gas boilers by 2035 will go ahead, despite warnings that the move could provoke a public backlash. Families will be encouraged to install low-carbon heating systems with grants of £5,000. Tory former Minister Steve Baker warned that the government faces a backlash when voters realise the costs involved of switching away from gas. Well, I'm joined by Alice Bell, climate author and also the co-director of climate campaign group Possible. Alice, do you think the government is, in fact, moving in the right direction?
We're definitely moving in the right direction, not necessarily moving fast enough, but we're definitely, it's welcome news that they're at least releasing this policy, and it's certainly saying roughly the right things, if just not quite with the right level of ambition.
How worried do you think people will be, given the economic climate and given what's expected of them?
Well, I think it's important to note that it isn't a ban. The Prime Minister himself was really keen to say that with a letter to Sun readers today. And it's not like anyone's going to be coming and taking your boiler away from you or asking you to necessarily move that fast. What it's doing is saying, all right, if you're going to be changing your boiler in the next few years, which many of us will be doing, you know, like any kind of big equipment like this, they only have a certain amount of life. Your next boiler might be a heat pump. And for people who might be doing that in the next few years, here's a little bit of extra money to help you do a bit faster and to mean that it's going to be a bit cheaper. And then the idea is that in a few years after that, the price of technology will have come down anyway. So it'll be much easier for anyone wanting to do that anyway. It's kind of similar to the sort of model we've seen with cars. You know, like a few years ago, it was only we, the rich geeks, who had electric vehicles. Now a lot of us are thinking, all right, I'd love to move now. I can't move yet, but my next car might well be an electric car. And for the first time in, you know, 150 years, electric cars are kind of starting to be almost comparable in price, or you know, they're going in that direction. The same thing will be happening with electric heating, and it'll allow us to, just like the cars, not only will it be something that helps us do all the things we need to do for climate change, but it'll also make our lives a lot healthier. Like, we don't think we really realize, a lot of us, how polluting our boilers are. Like, they cause a lot of air pollution just immediately around our homes and in the local area, just like cars cause a lot of air pollution. And it's a really important thing, just in terms of our health, that we swap out of these kind of old technologies of the gas powered boiler.
But is the replacement of gas-fired boilers really the best way forward?
Oh yeah, we definitely need to get off. It's an of this old technology. It's old, it's polluting. It's not even necessarily that reliable. I mean, 1 in 5 boilers in the UK breaks down over a winter anyway. I think a lot of us will probably have sworn off our boiler at some point in our lives. Having these new technologies, and what the government is, I mean, the headlines are all about heat pumps today, but behind that, the policy is actually a lot broader than that. It's not just heat pumps. For some people, that won't be appropriate. They are trialing, looking at things to do with hydrogen in some areas. That is still really uncertain as a technological option, but it's something that we need to look into and the government is looking into. They're also thinking about just how we all need to use less heat. At the moment, we waste a lot of heat. You know, we all spend a huge amount of money of our gas bill is just to create heat that goes out through our windows and doors and floors. So it's also about insulating our homes, and so that we don't have to waste so much energy, so we can be much, much more effective about it. It's about, there's going to be all sorts of other new technological things that will be able to be an innovative project. We'll be kicked off by things like this, like projects where we use waste heat from industry and use that to warm our homes. There's this great project in North London that is taking heat from the London Underground and using that to heat homes and the local swimming pool. So I hope in the next few years to see a lot more things like that as well.
People are, though, typically resistant to change, aren't they? So I think it's going to be quite an uphill struggle to convince many millions that they need to rejig their whole heating system. You know, it is a bit of a faff, isn't it?
It is, and I sympathise, because, I mean, heating's important. You know, like, we can't do this badly. If we do this badly, people will be literally left in the cold. Like, where I live, my heating is run, it's part of a heat network, which is sort of lower carbon, because I share my boiler with lots of people. It's run by the council, and it inevitably breaks down a lot, and it drives me up the wall. You know, to boil a kettle, to do the washing up, and go to the gym to have a shower. We don't want to be in that kind of position. So it's understandable people are apprehensive about the change, because even if their boiler breaks down a bit, they kind of know what to do if it breaks down. We don't necessarily want to rush this through too fast, but we do need to move fast, because it is so incredibly polluting. We need to just get off this technology. And we've left it, we've left it a long time. Government should have been starting this change decades ago, so it would have been a lot easier. I think what will happen, the current, it looks like big numbers. It's all about 3.9 billion and it seems huge. Actually, I think that money will be spent very quickly, with just within the houses, the properties of people who know they want to switch anyway and are just thinking, this thing that I thought was going to be really expensive and probably not able to do, the government's going to give me a bit of money to help me do it, and that'll go quite quickly. The thing I'm more worried about is kind of that all the other households that won't be able to use those grants, and we're going to need to see more from the government. I mean, really, this 3.9 billion should be nearer kind of 11 or 12 billion, and that being able to work across the whole of British society and kind of in places hold people's hands while they move over, because it is. In some properties, it will be a lot of work, and it's going to be scary, and it's important that the government is there to keep everyone warm through all of that.
Just on the macro level, and this isn't intended at all to be a facetious comment, we're told that the climate is getting ever warmer, presumably in future years, and maybe by 2035 significantly, because we will live in a warmer country, we won't need as much heating.
Oh, that is, I don't think there is facetious. It's a totally understandable reaction. It will probably still get cold, though. And, I mean, as we knew from the beast from the east 50 years ago, do you remember that? There was a lot of discussion about how that was partially caused by climate change. We could find that overall, if you look at all the temperatures for the whole year, it's been a little bit warmer. But actually, within that overall warming that we're getting, we have some days that are even colder. And so we really will need a good heating system. And the UK is only going to get so warm. I mean, the other thing about heat pumps, which is pretty amazing, is they work it both ways. They work a little bit like a reverse fridge. So, you know, like a fridge sometimes has heat at the back of it, because while it's making coldness, it creates heat. A heat pump works kind of in the other way. But they work both ways. So you can create cooling and heating. So for some people, it might be an option to install a heat pump that not only creates heat in the winter, but in the summer, which will be getting hotter, they can have aircon, which is something we haven't really had to worry about too much in the UK. But I imagine quite a few of your listeners will have sweated through a few days the last few summers where they thought, I wouldn't mind aircon. And wouldn't, I mean, at the moment, air conditioning is a real danger in terms of course, causing carbon emissions. But if we could do that, you know, that seems like the dream, doesn't it? A heating system that allows us to keep cool in the summer and warm in the winter. That sounds ideal without necessarily warming the planet.
Well, I look forward to living the dream. Alice, many thanks for taking the time. That was Alice Bell, climate author and also the co-director of climate campaign group Possible. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all of our podcasts, our videos, opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus. Doctors have launched a revolt against Sajid Javid's orders for them to see more patients face-to-face, with hundreds of GPs being told to ignore the guidelines. Practices in the south of England, serving millions of patients, have been advised not to participate in a letter from the head of the local medical committee, the LMC, which represents the area's GPs. Well, I'm joined now by Dennis Reid from Silver Voices, which campaigns for face-to-face access to GPs. Are you surprised, Dennis, by this reaction?
I am surprised and I'm rather annoyed as well, because I thought that the matter not had been put to bed, but at least there'd been progress made on the issue with the statement from the government. And what I was expecting was that the doctors, who have some concerns about resources, which I understand, but I thought that they would sit down with the government and actually talk about the practicalities of implementing better face-to-face access. So, yes, I am surprised, but also annoyed, because it does seem more arrogant that patients' choice is being overruled, really, in this way.
You could argue that, you know, GPs are pretty well remunerated and, you know, it's perhaps not the most overbearing job within the NHS. Patients are going to be angry, aren't they?
Yes, I mean, they are under pressure. I mean, thousands of them are, you know, really committed to the health of their patients, but it's their organisations, their national medical organisations, which appear to be taking this really hardline approach. And I know a lot of doctors locally would be quite happy if they had the resources, when they're getting some extra from the government, would be happy to extend the number of face-to-face appointments they've got. So yes, we are angry about it, because in none of the responses from the medical establishment, shall I say, do they recognise that we have any concerns at all about the move towards remote consultation. So they complain about it and say they can't do it and they don't want to do it. But they don't say, on the other hand, we do recognise that there are some concerns being expressed by Silver Voices and other patients' groups. They just don't say that side of the equation.
How political do you think this decision by the LMC is?
Well, it is a pretty, I mean, it's a calculated decision, isn't it, Richard? They've just had the advice down from government, and they're consciously snubbing their noses up at the government to send out this letter so quickly, say, basically saying don't take part in anything related to this initiative. They are snubbing their noses at the government, and I think the government needs to respond. The government needs to nip it in the bud, because it can't just let this spread. If they get away with it in these small areas, then it wouldn't surprise me if other LMCs take the same position.
Obviously, many older people are extremely technology savvy and use the internet, but others won't be quite so fluent when it comes to digital technology. Is this going to be an issue particularly for older people, do you think?
It is particularly for older people. Obviously, not just older people who want access to their GP. But, you know, if we look at people in their 80s and 90s, they're very unlikely to have ever used computers or new technology at work. So they're not going to be, you know, able to easily sort of download Zoom and so on so they can have a video consultation. They may not be able to afford it. But I think the other feature here is that a lot of older people are not comfortable talking over the phone or over video about intimate symptoms. They want to have a face-to-face discussion with the doctor to talk through things so that the doctor can assure them about, you know, what can be done with their particular medical condition. And that sort of empathetic human response seems to be missed out in all this.
And it also strikes me, Dennis, that in a sense, doctors might be stabbing themselves in the back, because what this will mean is that more and more people will go to A&E to present with a medical problem because of the fact that they can't go and see their GP. So it's going to put a strain on casualty units as well.
Yeah, they're already going down to A&E in droves, because if they can't get an appointment with a doctor for 3 weeks, which is often the case, and they feel that their condition is worsening, they're going to go straight down to A&E because they know that they might have to wait 4 or 5 hours, but at least they'll be seen by a qualified doctor that day. And that is the important thing. They are shooting themselves in the foot for another reason, because it's counterproductive. They've still got quite a lot of, as they should have, a lot of public support. But to take this really intransigent attitude is going to lose them public support. It's certainly losing support from some of our members who are writing in to me saying this is outrageous what the doctors are doing. They ought to sit down, talk to government, talk to Silver Voices, talk to patients groups about how we can improve things.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting to see what happens, if not probably slightly frustrating as ever. Thank you very much indeed. That was Dennis Reed from Silver Voices. Now it's time for our regular city update with Ruth Sunderland, business editor at the Daily Mail. And Ruth, vote today on whether Morrisons should be sold to private equity.
Yes, absolutely. So this is a big watershed moment, really, for the private equity industry and for the stock market. Shareholders in the supermarket group Morrisons, which is one of the big four, as you know, are voting today on a £7 billion takeover offer by Clayton, Dubilier & Rice, CD&R. They're a US private equity firm. They're voting on that deal today. They are expected to vote in favour of it. They're being offered a 61% premium on the share price before the bid landed. So they've got a very large profit on the table there for most of them, quite hard to resist. But obviously this raises questions above and beyond just that takeout price around the future of one of our biggest supermarkets, its thousands of employees, and also at a time when we've seen how important the supermarkets are throughout the pandemic. You know, will we be able to rely as much on US private equity to make sure the shelves are stocked, that they can deal with the supply shortages that we've seen and all of these challenges? So a bit of a watershed moment. CD&R have got Sir Terry Leahy, who is quite famous in city and business circles as a former boss of Tesco. He's a senior advisor of theirs. He's probably going to be the new chairman of Morrisons, so he'll be in charge. Maybe that's a bit comforting, but lots of questions about this takeover, assuming, of course, that there's not a big shock and upset and assuming that it does actually get voted through.
And fears that the British taxpayer might have to subsidise this private equity
indeed,
takeover.
Indeed, indeed. So you hit on a very important point there. So one of the issues around private equity is these deals tend to be very heavily indebted. And if you're heavily indebted and you're not making a profit, then you actually don't have to pay corporation tax, because you know it is a tax on profit. And additionally to that, the parent company of this new venture has been established in the Cayman Islands, which of course is a tax haven. Now they have said that they're going to pay all taxes that they're liable for in the UK. Well, fine, but then it begs the question, well, why have you got this Cayman Island company in the first place then? So, you know, that's another one there. But these deals are debt heavy and tax light. You know, that's a typical private equity scenario, unfortunately. Lots of question marks there for customers, for employees, and indeed for the UK taxpayer.
Well, quite. And you know, just finally, how is the takeover likely to affect the staff and the customers of Morrisons?
Well, what has happened is CD&R has made a number of pledges around employees and around the supply chain and around various other matters, things like, you know, the disposal of properties and fears of asset stripping. So it's made a list of apparent pledges, most of which only last for a year. So that's fairly short term. And despite the fact that they're saying at the moment, well, you know, we're not planning to get rid of loads of staff, and we're promising to keep their wages at the levels that are, you know, good levels on above the national minimum and meet the living wage and so forth. The issue with it is these promises, apparent promises, only hold good for quite a short period of time. And they're quite conditional in the sense that, you know, there's often wiggle room. So what we've seen in the past on private equity deals is, to be absolutely blunt, these promises are not really worth the paper that they're written on. So I think, you know, we hope that Morrison's staff that their jobs will be safe. We hope indeed that this all works very well and that the company grows and hires more people. But any change of control, you can't sugarcoat it. It's an anxious time, and particularly when private equity are involved, unfortunately.
Ruth, many thanks as ever. That was Ruth Sunderland, the business editor at the Daily Mail. Now, do you remember Baby Shark, the jaunty earworm that every child couldn't get enough of? Well, it's finally been knocked off the top spot in the iTunes Children's Charts by another no less catchy tune. Children's entertainer Amanda Frolish, a.k.a. Action Amanda, has penned a song with a message all about mental health, and it's proved a hit, and I'm joined by Amanda now. Amanda, just tell me about the inspiration for this song.
Hello. Well, thank you for the opportunity to have me here today. Yeah, so during the pandemic, Alison and I, obviously, we've been writing music for many years, and we just thought, you know, you've got the NHS, everybody cheering and clapping, and it was all about washing your hands, so we produced the Wash Your Hands, and then we thought, the children need a shout out. What can we do to celebrate, you know, what they've been up to in this crisis? And we thought it would just be really nice to talk about, it's their time to shine for what they've endured. And we decided to, Alison came up with the title Time to Shine, because we wanted to cultivate their confidence and just produce a feel-good song. And that's how it all started, really.
I'm an enormous fan, or was an enormous fan, of The Beautiful South. What was it like working with Alison?
Well, funny enough, I met Alison about 15 years ago when she attended one of my classes, my physical development classes in Wandsworth, in a little cafe called Skylark. She attended with her child, and obviously I didn't know who she was, and we just started talking, and I said that I make music, and she said she was a musician. So of course I went back and looked her up, and I just plucked up the courage the following week and said, Alison, I know this is really cheeky, but is there any way we could make music together? And she's so humble, she's just absolutely incredible to work with. She's helped me with lots of other charity events, Great Ormond Street, the Buttle Foundation. And we started literally making songs together. And here we are now, topping Baby Shark to the number one top hit. Yes, it's just been incredible.
The mental health of young people is so prominent in the news at the moment. I mean, in the number of discussions I've had about it with various people, I can't count them. Just talk a little bit about how serious an issue you think that is, and also, in a jaunty way, if you want to use that word, how this song addresses it.
Yeah, well, if you go back to basics, if we think about it, with anyone's mental health, you're going to feel better if you move. And my concept is using props in a physical and fun way, linking these props to a song, and then linking everything to the early years foundation stage. So, you know, with children's mental health and also adults' mental health, even if you go for a walk and you just start breathing, everything is going to help. But I think the main message here is what we've learned from the pandemic. Some children and families were living in, you know, flats and small accommodation. And for us, it's all about getting children dancing, singing. It's all about movement for me and mental health. So that's where it all stemmed from, is getting children active and learning to be healthy from an early age, to just make you feel better and shine.
Do the lyrics reflect a message about mental health?
It's all about being confident, being strong, and it's our time to shine. And I think the message that the song has two meanings, because the first version wasn't orchestrated, but the second version is, and it just got this real feel good factor, and it's really easy listening, and it just has the clear message that it's everyone's time to shine. So we wrote the song, as I say, during the pandemic, and it was all about how we were feeling. And you know, the message is, now is our time to shine coming out of the pandemic, because we've all just missed out so much. And I'm a birthday party entertainer, so it's a real time for celebration, going out, having fun with your families, being able to do what we used to do. And so, yes, the song had a meaning in with our mental health during the pandemic, but now it's our time to shine coming out the other end.
And just briefly, how can we get it?
The main link would be to go onto iTunes, please. So you'll see two versions. There's one version where you'll see all of the artists who performed, but it's the one that we would like to get everybody to download is the album you'll see on iTunes, which has a blue background with stars, and there's a character of myself as Action Amanda. That's the one we would love everybody to download to get us back into the charts. That would be amazing. And hopefully the UK top 40 would be amazing, please. And it's 59 pence. And all the money goes to the Mental Health Foundation, all proceeds. So I would please be so thankful if your listeners could download it for us. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about the song today.
It's been uplifting to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. That was children's entertainer Amanda Frolish, a.k.a. Action Amanda. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Richard Spur, and this is the Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have a great evening. Good night.